This episode of the Living Poetry Podcast was recorded on the 25th of August, 2011. My name is Bartholomew Barker, and I'm joined by Tara Lynn Groff, Pamela Taylor, and Angelica Teuber. We're the organizers of Living Poetry, a collection of poets and poetry readers in the Raleigh-Durham metropolitan area of North Carolina. Check out livingpoetry.net, search for Living Poetry on Facebook, and if you reside in the Piedmont, join our Living Poetry meetup group. Tonight we're discussing ekphrastic poetry, which, generally speaking, is poetry describing or inspired by a work of visual art. Probably the most famous ekphrastic poem is Ode to a Grecian Urn by John Keats, 1819. That's the one that ends, "Beauty is truth, truth beauty, that is all you need know on earth, and all you need to know." Now, I was going through and read the whole thing, and I must admit, I just didn't care for the poem. It sounds awful. It's Keats, but it really feels like a 200-year-old poem. I much preferred Ode to a Grecian Urn summarized by Desmond Skiro. He wrote this in 1960. "God's chase, round vase, what say, what play? Don't know. Nice, though."
Which is probably what most people think when they look at that. Oh, this is nice.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Yeah. So it just captures the sentiment of when sometimes you look at art.
Yeah. Or sometimes you read a really long classic poem that just doesn't translate to our modern sensibilities.
Those last few lines are like the ones that I think have stood the test of time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what other ekphrastic poems did you ladies find?
Our own?
Your own or anything else?
Well, I have this number five poem. The picture's actually by Charles, and I'm going to most probably say their name wrong, DeMuth, 1883 till 1935. And it's the number five. It's a golden number five on a black and red background, and the number five appears again and again. And actually, William Carlos Williams wrote a poem about that picture. It's fairly short. It's called "The Great Figure." "Among the rain and lights, I saw the figure five, in gold, on a red fire truck, moving, tense, unheeded, to gong clangs, siren, howls, and wheels rumbling through the dark city."
Interesting.
Yeah, I think that's, when you say interesting, that's one of the most interesting facts about ekphrastic poetry to me, is you pick up on a vibration of another art form, and then you write about that, and so the vibration is something different for every poet.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So the same picture could inspire quite different poems, and that's what actually appeals to me the most, is just how different it's received, and to from that perspective, it's very personal.
Yeah.
The reflection,
right,
or the relationship between the poem and whatever other art form you've used, is very personal.
Because I think the poem doesn't necessarily need to describe exactly what's going on in the picture or painting, but it has to make you want to see what the poet saw in the picture.
Yes.
I think that's, you know, a good poem, you know, makes you want to say, "Ooh, what's that about?" You know, so that, like you said, I can have my own inspiration from whatever he saw, but it gets you to want to see what he saw.
Yes.
For yourself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think with other art forms, they take so much longer to create than a poem might. As you know, like the Grecian urn and paintings, like so when you think of what the artist was thinking, that they devoted that much time to get their own message across.
That's the thing that's always really stunned me about working in something real,
mm-hmm,
like a painting or sculpture or something like that. I mean, if you make a mistake, you can do damage to the thing. You know, the worst that can happen to a poem is it is forgotten. You know, even before computers, before the backspace key. You could still handwrite it, and as long as that piece of paper was around, but if you screwed up a word or you crossed it out, you can rewrite it, you can copy it endlessly. So I have a lot more respect for the physical artists for that reason.
Yeah. and you can revise it endlessly. You
mm-hmm.
know, whereas, like what Rodin said about a block of marble, is the figure is already in it. It reveals itself to you as you chisel away at it. If you hack off a toe, you know, if that figure was a foot and the toe is gone, that thing is destroyed. Whereas we tend to revise and revise and revise
mm-hmm.
without destroying the poem necessarily.
Yeah. Hopefully we make it better.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very.
I have one. And it was while I was in Paris and looking at the Venus de Milo statue. And I was more looking at what was in, what was not there as opposed to what was there. But what really stopped me was how kind of exquisite and polished it looked. And it was made in 100 BC. And just thinking of, people didn't live as long back then, and to put the time into creating something that beautiful. And then there was a little plaque about how they never were able to find her arms and her hands. So it's just, you know, whatever's left of it today. So this is called What Is Lost Is Lost. Sometimes I misplace things and I retrace my steps. I may find a key in an old jacket pocket or a freshly laundered $20 bill amongst my whites. Other times, what is lost is lost. Someone once explained to me it's archaeologists from the future, traveling back in time to us and stealing our belongings, and they can be forgetful, careless, and neglect to return these precious pieces of living history. Sunglasses, a favorite t-shirt, love letters. Other times what is lost is lost. Our misplaced things are probably wherever Venus de Milo's hands and arms are resting, missing, unknown, creating a whole new life for themselves.
I do like that idea, the archaeologist coming back from the future.
Well, I have one that was inspired by photography that a friend of mine did. And it's just a picture of a firework in the sky. And so I kind of made up a story to go with it, as opposed to like trying to describe it. So it's called Spark. One hand gropes in the dark and finds its match. Now fingers intertwine like stacked wood, transferring heat from pressed palms to wrapped arms, pulling closer and closer. Then lips touch, and the miracle of fire burns slow through hips and toes. Embers of shared breath rise high and spark another flame. Mm.
That's beautiful.
Nice.
So, I mean, it's just like where your imagination takes you, so.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I've got one that was inspired by the 19th century poster, the advertising poster that Henri Toulouse-Lautrec did
mm-hmm.
about for Jane Avril, that really famous one of her doing the
mm-hmm.
can-can. I let men believe the rhythm of the bass makes me lose control of my feet, my legs, my hips, that I must yield to the frantic beat, that I don't mean to reveal these petticoats. But of course, it's all a show, and men are simple to control.
That's nice. I like how it's the rhyme at the end. Really emphasizes.
Yeah, one of my poems that I typically don't read. I'm not sure really how polished it is, but I like it for the emotional connection I have with it. We were prompted to write a poem about either one of two pictures, and the picture I pick is actually called The Flight of the Witches, and there are three witches halfway up in the air tossing around a naked human, and underneath all of that turmoil is a guy covering himself with a white sheet, trying to escape. And I thought, well, I'm not going to write about the witches as such. I'm going to write about that guy that is trying to escape and not face whatever is in his life. And so it's called Witches. While tossing about an agonized human in his nightmare, conjuring up primal angst of falling and naked vulnerability, he will wake up soaked in his own sweat with the fear of falling asleep again. The witches sense the other one sneaking off. He really thinks he can slip past us unnoticed, believes we don't know his cowardly heart and sly mind. He's convinced we can't see his life in the half shadow, that we have to touch him to uncover his shifty ways. Insult ignites the witch's fury and wicked mischief. Let's curse him with infallible exposure. On three.
This is based off the Cezanne painting L'Estaque, which is the name of a little seaside village in the south of France. Cezanne did a painting of that in 1883, and then Allen Ginsberg wrote a poem about it in 1950 called Cezanne's Ports. In the foreground, we see time and life, swept in a race, toward the left-hand side of the picture, where shore meets shore. But that meeting place isn't represented. It doesn't occur on the canvas. For the other side of the bay is heaven and eternity, with a bleak white haze over its mountains. The immense water of L'Estaque is a go-between for minute rowboats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, that's one of the things that makes you want to see the picture,
yes.
The painting.
Yeah. New Descending a Staircase was written by X.J. Kennedy, who was actually, I had read up on this a little bit, and he had been in a museum, I want to say in Washington, D.C., but I can't remember, and had looked at this cubist picture. It's really just cubes in a flesh color on a black background. And if I'm not mistaken, it's called the same as the poem's title, New Descending a Staircase. And so he came up with this three-stanza, fairly short poem. Toe upon toe, a snowing flesh, a gold of lemon, root and rind, she sifts in sunlight down the stairs with nothing on nor on her mind. We spy beneath the banister a constant thresh of thigh on thigh. Her lips imprint the swinging air, the parts to let her parts go by. One woman waterfall, she wears her slow descent like a long cape, and pausing on the final stair, collects her motions into shape. Yeah, I like that too. Like, you can imagine that he would see these cubes at, like, just like Ginsberg said about Cezanne's building, the meaning of shore on shore is outside the painting, right? So in this cubist picture, you can see those cubes in flesh color meet up to form a woman just outside the canvas.
Right.
Yeah.
I've actually done a lot of haiku, and it's mostly for my mom.
Yeah.
Because she's been working on a project where she's translating
her
work is actually ekphrastic also,
yeah,
in a way, because what she does, she translates visual art, like mostly paintings, and she color codes them in fabric so the blind can interpret the color.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, it's called, she calls it the B code, the Barker code.
Nice.
And so she's running, and she asked me to write some haiku for this, so she did a Jane Avril also, but that one got too big. I couldn't do that one in a haiku. And some of the other ones she's done, like she did, like, The Red Poppy by George O'Keefe.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's one of them.
Yeah, and that came out beautifully. So that's, you know, that just begs to be tactile.
Yeah.
You know, that beautiful red there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Red Poppy by George O'Keefe. Red as slick blood oozing from a wound, poppies sleep in battlefields, fertilized by lies.
By lies.
I know. Like, just kind of went treacherous there.
Yeah.
Blood and everything.
And you want to say, you want to think lives. Mm-hmm. And then lives.
Exactly.
I don't know. This one, I felt, described exactly what was going on in the poem, in the picture that I had. So I'm just going to read it and so you can imagine what it looks like. It's called The Climb. You climb to the top of the staircase, winded, legs trembling with fatigue. Most don't make it this far. To them, the top rung remains as mysterious as heaven, as elusive as the American dream. Your mother and grandmothers bowed down to scrub or yes, sir, their way through the day. Your fathers and forefathers broke their backs digging ditches or were broken down for speaking up. Steeper steps rise like skyscrapers beside the mountaintop of their sacrifices. You're halfway there and must go the rest of the way alone.
Yeah, so this was a picture of a black man standing on a staircase. He's at the top, and then all of a sudden, like, you see this other huge, giant steps to his left, you know, and it's like, you know, what?
So
yeah, and it's like, that's you still have to go further. So I felt that the poem just really described what was going on. I mean, I get a little bit of the backstory, but it's just, you know, that whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
My voracious reader poem, which has inspired Angelica. Yeah, so this poem, it had originally started, I had this weird dream like a year before I wrote this poem, and I woke up thinking, I wiped the crumbs of Nietzsche from my shirt. I've never read Nietzsche, still haven't read any of them, so I don't know why that was in my head, but I wrote that line down, and then one day I was writing poems, I took it out, and then I wrote all of this around it, which is inspired by all different pieces of literature. So, voracious reader. Growling, roaring, rumbling, tumbling, I'm hungry. No steak done rare can satiate my thirst for blood. No cannoli from a Brooklyn bakery, no bread, nothing can fill me except words. I eye my caged bird singing, and it begins to look like a delectable snack. The song just aroused to distract me from my next meal. A catfish from the Mississippi that a huckleberry caught is served on a platter, about to be devoured. I wipe the crumbs of Nietzsche from my shirt and swallow the last bit of Thoreau, pond water rushing down my last supper. I cringe at the final course, but I'm still so hungry, so I tear into Steinbeck, swirling mice tails flicking past my lips, and the dust settles.
Yeah, no, so I'm not sure if you would call that still ekphrastic poetry, but Tarlin's poem inspired one of my poems where I had read Eating Poetry by Mark Strand, and I love the poem. I think it's really great, but I thought the library setting was so dry, and even though he inserted the dogs there, I thought, man, you know, if you can't get enough of poetry, that should sound different, more beastly, really. And then so I had that idea in my head for a while, but then I heard Tarlin's poem, and the Nothing Can Fill Me inspired me then to write this poem. It's called Eating Poetry, just like Mark Strand's. I crave poetry. I ride the waves of rhythm and rhyme. I hop down the visual structure on the page. I feed on my emotional connection. I feast on my discovery of kinship. I crave poetry. The more poetry I devour, the more famished I get. Like Hydra's head, I eat one poem and the hunger for two grows back. I swallow every line, yet nothing fills me. I crave poetry. I turn beast in my voracious pursuit, following the scent of old favorites and new artists. Raw meat hanging from the corners of my mouth, inky blood dripping down my chin. I am so ravenous for poetry, I forget to eat.
That one seems like it can inspire a painting. I mean, yeah, but I like that. It was like,
it's torn open.
Yeah, I mean, but it's like, but yours, going back to ekphrastic, it was like, it was
you know, it's the literature that's really inspiring.
Yes.
That, or, you know, where you said even a dream that kind of went there. So the image or something in a dream and that inspired that, and then you were inspired off of that. I love that about her.
The Starry Night by Anne Sexton?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The town does not exist, except where one black-haired tree slips up like a drowned woman in the hot sky. The town is silent. The night boils with 11 stars. Oh, starry, starry night, this is how I want to die. It moves, they are all alive. Even the moon bulges in its orange irons to push children like a god from its eye. The old unseen serpent swallows up the stars. Oh, starry, starry night, this is how I want to die. Into that rushing beast of the night, sucked up by that great dragon, to split from my life with no flag, no belly, no cry.
It's such a fluid picture,
right?
With all these brush strokes.
Mm-hmm.
And hers is fluid too, even though it conjures up three distinct images.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's interesting.
I've actually had the privilege of seeing Starry, Starry Night in person. It's at the Met in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed at how three-dimensional it was, how thick those brush strokes are really coming out of the off the canvas.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize it would be like that. You know, from all the reproductions, you don't get that sense.
Right. Yeah.
But it was...
And actually, that's something that the Impressionists, which are the painters in that period, had to fight against, is that the paintings before then, you didn't see a brush stroke. You know, the perfection and the accuracy of exact imitation was the height of quality. And for the first time, Monet and Manet and all those actually brought that life into the picture and saying, you know, at different times the light is different and therefore it's a different picture. And they made this brushstroke visible, and therefore they weren't actually exhibited anywhere because it was considered dirty work because you could see actually the brushstrokes. I have another aspect of ekphrastic poetry that that we could talk about. I wrote this poem. I actually wrote, off Robert Lee Brewer's prompts, I wrote a poem to both pictures.
Okay.
And the poem I wrote to the other picture, I actually did quite a bit of research on. And so, like, what do you think or feel about bringing in sort of research and almost combining educational poem with sort of what you connect with a poem? Do you think that distracts from the picture and the poem, or do you think...
If it's well done, it supplements.
Right,
you know?
I mean, it depends. I mean, because part of it is like what you see in there that may not be accessible to everyone who doesn't know the history behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing the research, you bring that out, and so it makes the picture more meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the painter is painting in a time where everyone has a historical context,
mm-hmm,
for what he's painting, and so
yeah,
they're automatically going to have the same types of connections in their mind when they see it, but hundreds of years later, you know, the people looking at that are not going to have the same, you know, the same historical context or background. So, you know, if you bring that in, that helps.
Yeah. I like that argument because I thought it can only add dryness, but it can add richness,
yes,
if you look at it from that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote this poem. So the picture shows Pocahontas running in front of a deer, so the deer following her through woods, and she is in her native Indian gear, like dress, and in the far distance there's a ship on the water. And so the poem is entitled Rebecca Rolfe, and the picture is entitled Pocahontas. And for those who don't know, Rebecca Rolfe is her name when she had migrated to England. Unconventionally, she was baptized at the age of 17 and moved from the Americas to England at 19. Fitting into British society was hard, and adopting manners and social conventions was as difficult as learning their language. After 3 years in the old world, a ship would finally carry her back home to her old self, her instinctual self, to her old life where she was one with nature, where she ran with deer and swam with fish. A place where she understood the language of trees, where the earth would talk to her in rumbles, where her people communicated with spirits, where the great eagle guided their plans, and all creatures knew her real name, Pocahontas. But Rebecca Worf never left England. Dying on the ship, right off the coast, she was buried in Gravesend, her spirit reuniting with the Great Mother. And I wasn't sure if there was too much research in the poem. Yeah.
No,
it's pretty fact-based.
Yeah,
so this was inspired by a story that my friend who was hitchhiking in the country last year, now he has a van, so he's vanning the country now.
Safer.
Yeah.
Nowhere near as interesting.
So this is called Angel. Outside a church, a young man waits. Inside, families shake the roof with hymns, spread their word, shed their sins. The service lets out. Sunday's best exit the doors. They don't know where this man came from. The congregation passes him as they go, to their cars, brunches, and homes. His thumb is up. He's waiting to learn where he's going. He stays until all have gone, then sheds his jacket and bears wings that beat with the force of 1,000 doves. The wings beat fast. The downy dust spreads the smell of lilies. He rises over the church town. His head is low, but higher his wings take him, to spread their words, shed their sins.
And I was inspired by, just that the people passing him by part of it.
Mm-hmm.
To write this poem that sort of came out from things of my childhood. So I used to go to church a lot.
Well, every Sunday.
It's called Youth Sunday. I'm picked to lead the congregation in worship. I stand and sit on the pulpit, fold my hands and bow my head in the Methodist way, the way I've been taught, the only way I know. For the sermon, I mimic the message preached week after week. Everyone is our brother. After the service, my mother beams as deaconesses and stewards praise the words, give grace, show mercy, be compassionate. Going home, my mother and I clutch patent leather purses as we pass souls lost and hungry, begging for spare change. I move my lips like she does, whispering prayers for them, for us.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I think another side of it, instead of these people, spending their money on brunch instead of giving him a ride or giving him money for his breakfast, they are in their own way.
Right. But it's the same issue of, here people are coming out of church where you're supposed to learn to love everybody, and they are ignoring the people around them, who they just said that they're supposed to love.
Yeah.
So
but they think that their prayers are enough.
Yes.
That's what they feel like they're justified.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can do a whole other podcast on hypocrisy, too.
But yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I want to close with a poem that's was a popular song about in 1974. This was off the Queen album, Queen 2.
Queen 2.
The poem was written by Freddie Mercury.
Freddie Mercury.
Yeah, the Freddie Mercury.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful song. I urge you all to download it for free from wherever you can find it. Freddie's dead. He's not going to get any royalties from
YouTube.
It's based on a piece of art called The Fairy Feller's Masterstroke, which was painted by Richard Dadd. It took him 9 years to paint this picture.
No way.
It did. And it is insane. It is literally insanely detailed. Richard Dadd painted this within an insane asylum when he was confined there. He was a patricide. He killed his father. And he had some mental issues. But just a few.
Well, he didn't marry his mother, so.
Just had a few, but they were really deep.
Yes. And the painting's now in the Tate Museum in London. So, The Fairy Feller's Masterstroke by Freddie Mercury. He's a fairy fellow. The fairy folk have gathered round the new moon's shine to see the feller crack a nut at night's noontime. To swing his axe, he swears, as he climbs, he dares to deliver the master stroke. Plowman, wagoner will and types, politician with senatorial pipe, he's a dilly-dallyo. Pedagogue squinting wears a frown, and a satyr peers under a lady's gown. He's a dirty fellow. What a dirty laddio. Tattered a million and the junketer, there's a thief and a dragonfly trumpeter. He's my hero. Fairy dandy tickling the fancy of his lady friend, the nymph in yellow. What a quarry fellow. Soldier, sailor, tinker, tailor, plowboy, waiting to hear the sound, and the arch-musician presides. He is the leader. Oberon and Titania watched by a harridan. Mab is the queen, and there's a good apothecary man come to say hello. The ostler stares with his hands on his knees. Come on, Mr. Feller, crack it open if you please. Fairy dandy tickling is the fancy of his lady friend, the nymph in yellow. What a quarry fellow. So apparently, Richard Dadd wrote a poem based on his own picture.
Oh.
And it's on Wikipedia. And it was not worth reading here. It would have been a whole podcast unto itself. But Freddie read that and pulled out all these different characters.
Okay.
And there are, I don't know how many figures you count in this painting.
Yeah, it seems like
it
there's
is
a
tremendous.
Lot going on.
There's a ton going on. It is a wonderful representation of insanity. But it's a wonderful song. The Fairy Feller's Masterstroke by Richard Dadd, D-A-D-D. That concludes this episode of the Living Poetry Podcast. Please visit our website, livingpoetry.net. If you have any comments or questions, please send an email to podcast@livingpoetry.net. This has been Bartholomew Barker, Tara Lynn Braun, Pamela Taylor, and Angelica Kloiber. Living Poetry.